Accession number 14208, reel 5.
Siganov,
reel 5. So, Gorbachev, in my view, was no peace pigeon. He was one of the people who thought they could stop the development of the event simply by radical measures. I'm not saying necessarily by military force. Maybe Gorbachev had something different in mind. But Gorbachev, the way I see him, was never afraid of intimidation as a political tool. And I believe that he didn't mind to employ it and use it during the negotiations with the heads of states of the Belarusia and Kazakhstan and Ukraine. So, talking about the Union Treaty, I'm sure that he was trying to introduce his version of a Union Treaty. Of course, the country was discussing just a general document, which was not disclosed in full detail to the citizens to judge about it. Therefore, we don't even know what kind of Union Treaty Gorbachev had in mind. But one thing is clear to me, that the person of his stature, a person of his background, heavy Communist Party background, a person in his 50s and maybe 60s, a person which belonged to the Communist Party establishment of the Stalin time, whether he was liberal or not, never mind, because the environment, of course, influences the person. Who is in a position of a president? So my idea is that Mr. Gorbachev was very much involved and acted as a communist era leader in resolution of all those Union Treaty questions, along with other leaders. When Yeltsin stepped in as a newly evolved power, as the person who personified the independent and non-offensive Russia, a quiet little goat of Russia, it really changes the whole outlook. In a way, I think it was Yeltsin who brought those people at the negotiations table and introduced a much flexible, open concept of Commonwealth of Independent States, which was later adopted. And I believe that's exactly what should have been done 2 years prior to 1991 and 89, when it was clear that the country is falling apart. Not troops, not military or political coercion, but a free determination and realization of those nations that they cannot exist without economic strong and very binding economic cooperation between all the republics. The reason why is that the former Soviet Union economically was established as a very fragmented country, that the plants and factories in one part of the country were dependent on their functionality simply by the fact that they had to import the parts and all kinds of details from different other regions, and there was no way they could be self-sufficient or they could build the new plants of the suppliers, suppliers bases, simply for the reason there was no money. The economy was at large bankrupt. So whatever we are observing right now in Russia is a direct result of a political fiasco rather than the failure of some sort of economic policy or line.
What was it like, though, you know, to be a Soviet citizen during this very turbulent period? You know, were you very worried about the sort of security situation in the country?
I was not worried about security, personal security, or security of the country in 1989, because in a way I still felt like I'm a citizen of a great, huge country. I'm Russian and Russian-speaking in the largely Russianly populated country with colonized fringes or colonized republics on the fringe of Russia. I felt like I'm a respected person from a very well-established agency. I was extremely secure because I knew that my status allows me to do things other citizens were not. And by that I mean free travel paid by the agency, security, the comfort within the borders of the Russian troops stationed somewhere in Georgia or Armenia or something, simply because I worked for the government, and it gave me some extra perks to be aware of and extra security to be aware of.
You're looking at it from the outside. The situation seems so unstable at that time. Did you not feel the ground was sort of moving under your feet?
No, I never felt it. Again, you should take into account that Moscow, St. Petersburg, Central Russia, even for the matter of Vladivostok, where I traveled a lot, which is far east of Russia, on a border with, on a sea border with Japan. It was a very stable environment. Whatever Russian was still under the yoke of Moscow. And, of course, Russians never revolted against their government. It was primarily different countries with different ethnic non-Russian population. Now, in those countries, I felt sometimes a bit insecure. But, again, you should take into account that I was not a typical Russian in a typical Russian setting or a typical Soviet setting. I came from a very ethnic background, and some of my relatives are living still in Central Asia or in Lithuania or in Moldova. So, and some of them are Russians, but some of them are not Russians as well. I'm saying that just to prove to you that I was rather flexible in dealing with different people, different races, and different nationalities. I never had any cultural problems or problems of intercultural communication with people down south and up north. It was clear to me that I'm doing fine as long as regarding the insecurity from the point of view of changing climates, ethnic climates, or changing local climates in terms of local politics, the insurgents, all kinds of resentment towards Russians. Yes, I did feel it. Sometimes, very often, confronted. But I believe that personally, I never posed any threat or any was not neither dangerous nor irritating the people I dealt with. I can confirm, though, that many other Russians were. And there were plenty of clashes in the country between Russians and non-Russians in different provinces and different areas. Needless to say that Russians in Central Asia or Moldavia, especially present-time Moldavia, are very tough-minded, nationalist-oriented, aggressive people. They would not tolerate the concept of living in a foreign country or considering Moldova as a foreign country. They consider Moldova or Ukraine or Uzbekistan, for the matter, part of Russia, since the ancestors lived there for years and years and years, and they consider themselves Russians, although many of them are mixed up. Mixed in their blood consistence. So we're talking about very different people, very different circumstances. Again, we should not judge about those formerly Soviet republics as just ethnically non-Russian. We have to take into account that at that time, and especially now, there are plenty of Russians living there in a minority status. And if before 1991 the minority over there was very influential, since all the bureaucrats in the government, local governments, and intelligentsia, doctors, surgeons, teachers, you name it, were primarily Russians. Now they're still there, and we're talking about 25 million people. That is a good chunk of the Russian population living abroad. They would not consider those countries independent. And sorrowful as it may seem, unfortunately, even those Russians living in the Baltic republics would never consider Baltic area as an independent and sovereign area, which sort of creates a good deal of instability till that very day.
Yes, going back to Yeltsin, you know, in 91, your view of him seems very positive. What do you think of Boris Yeltsin today in the light of what has happened since, his policies and his actions?
I'm one of those people who are very upset about Russians themselves castigating their governments. Russians seem to be never content with the people they install in power. And I don't want to be one of those who are criticizing all the time the government. But at the same time, I cannot help but not to notice that Yeltsin is very quickly moving to the right. And primarily in the present time circumstances in Russia where hardliners seem to be more popular type of leaders rather than, you know, pigeons like Gorbachev, or especially when he came to power in 1986. I believe that Yeltsin is going through the same very transformation Gorbachev went in a period of time, 1985 till 1991. That is moving from the point somewhere to the left from the center, quickly to the extreme right. And for Gorbachev, it was certainly a necessity, because he understood, being a political animal as he was, that he would not survive unless he will have the backing of the party and state machine, plus he will have this strongman sort of strongman perception or strongman image in the eyes of the nation. That was obvious in the 1991 when the Soviet Union was falling apart. Now, as to Yeltsin, the same thing, only Yeltsin is not dealing anymore with the Soviet Union, he's dealing with a falling apart Russia. And this is not a statement, this is a fact, looking, judging by the events happening in Northern Caucasia, or Caucasus, which has announced itself independent, or Republic of Tatarstan, which announced itself sovereign and independent, or Republic of Yakutia, or known in another way as Saha, which just announced itself independent 2 years ago. And how many other regions could split off from the Soviet, from the Russia? It's obvious that plenty are non-Russianly populated and might be searching for their identity and their way of existence. And that means that Yeltsin has to deal with a problem Gorbachev dealt before. The only problem is that the Soviet Union was not predominantly Russianly populated, or was not populated predominantly by Russians. It was populated by so many, by 108 nationalities, and with at least 150 languages spoken in different corners of the huge country. Now, Yeltsin has to deal with at least 147 million people, with 25 million people living abroad, but still with a large portion of non-Russian ethnic population. And that is within Russia. That is within the borders of the country itself. So Yeltsin is no longer the person who could say, well, why don't we just let everybody be independent and form Russian Confederation instead of Russian Federation, which exists now. He is facing certainly a much tougher challenge. It is sort of like fighting within Britain, trying to keep Yorkshire within. So, which is blood of the blood is a British territory. So we're talking about the same problem as Yeltsin's trying to keep all those little republics with large portions of non-ethnic, non-Russian population within. Again, how he would do it, there are two ways, but one of them is certainly a very familiar, old, traditional Russian way: become a strongman, become a father of the nation, become a sort of a Stalin type leader, which will stop the disintegration, which will stop the collisions of Russians with all those small nationalities. The promising note here is that Yeltsin is still a rather serious and sensible person who understands the inadmissibility of military solutions here. Till what time, until what period of time, he will continue to realize that, it is very important, because I believe that coming out from the same Communist Party elite, from the same Communist Party establishment, he's still very much full of those instincts. Instincts which are adhering to people with the low educational levels as they were in the Communist Party. And they, in Yeltsin, who is shown to the world that he is a good crisis manager of the crisis situation, like it was 1991 or 1993, a person who is never scared by the challenge to fight with the enemy and to fight, you know, head to head, could be an appropriate person to deal with the self-determination and sovereignty of the little nations within Russia. Might be the wrong person to resolve the national questions and shape up the new Russian Federation or Confederation or whatever will be the substitute for the present time Russia.
You return to, I know you're living partially in the United States at the moment, aren't you?
That's correct.
Sergei, but you return regularly to Russia. Do you still have Russian citizenship?
Yeah, I still keep my Russian citizenship. And I intend to do that for a little while.
Yeah. So when you return to Russia, what is the condition of life for the Russian people? This would be your main experience, I imagine, when you return. You know, what has it given the Russian people, the changes since 91?
It is a very complex question, and the reason why I'm saying that is because we're talking about a very diverse Russian population. There is no way you could describe it in two or three sentences, simply because there are different groups of, demographically, there are different groups of people, different kinds of people, different lifestyles, different cultural settings, which one should not omit when talking about it. I would say that the reforms of free market reforms and shock therapy brought very different results and different impacts on different types of people. If we're talking about an older generation, and unfortunately it becomes almost a stereotype, their approach to viewing of the reforms is very negative, because they're losing their security, they're losing their economical prosperity. Prosperity, I would say, they're losing any kind of economic base they used to have before. Russia was a very group-oriented society, even before Bolsheviks, but it became extremely collectivized and group-oriented society under communists. So the majority of the old people who fought in the war and worked in those five-year plans after the war, they got used to the planned economy and maybe inefficient but very regular socialized sphere, the social services. They are used to getting regularly salary benefits, being sent for vacations down south. They're used to having some kind of kindergartens, as bad as they were for free. They're used for all those benefits, and maybe I'm speaking a little bit from the stance of the Republican Party in the United States, but they're used to being given a pocket money to live on anytime. So they consider the state sort of like their parent, who used to take care of them and was fostering them in the right way, and they were just happy to enjoy that. Well, the time is over. They don't understand it. They don't understand the fact that they're dealing with a more or less affair type of economy, that Russian economy is no longer have a space for them. And unless they want to change themselves and become more aggressive and ambitious and entrepreneurial, there is nobody who's going to come again and give them the pocket money. And unfortunately, this realization never works, because people are very spoiled by the 72, 74 years of enjoying the inefficient socialist society. Now, there is another generation, which is a transitional one, and whether you can call it I call it the generation of Soviet bureaucrats, who quickly understood that their positions in the government or in some key positions in economy or science could give them certain advantages. Therefore, although reluctantly, but they're moved into a sphere of willing and dealing, and maybe not productive enough, but are sharpening their sales skills right now, whether it's the skills of selling military technology or selling expertise or selling office design plans or something. This generation is surviving, but it doesn't have any future. And although those people are certainly benefiting from and profiteering on the reform, are not happy with it, because they see much younger, much more ambitious generation of young people quickly entering the market with very sharp plans, business plans, opening up their companies, enterprises, and literally buying out everything all over. This young generation of business people, we may be talking about only 1% of the whole population, is very successful, is earning a lot of profits, although being sometimes involved in indecent and criminal unions. But the traditional Russian argument that the United States has not been built by nuns and priests, it was built by people like like Morgan or Rothschild or Rockefeller or that type of personalities. So, and they were not exactly the nicest personalities in their first and second generation. So, I don't know whether the argument is appropriate in Russia at this point or not. One wants to believe that it takes more genteel people to develop the country. But Russia doesn't have any choice at this point. And unfortunately, the criminal groups and corruption and mafia, which is all pervading in the economy at this point, hopefully will disappear as soon as the country will produce new people with a new mentality.
Meanwhile, people like Zhirinovsky have come to prominence. You know, how do you view him?
I think that Zhirinovsky essentially is a reflection of all the resentment and grievances of the Russian citizens as to what the Russian government of Boris Yeltsin is doing in introducing the reforms and the way they implement the reform. I think it is not just resentment, not just political resentment, it's also a very very personal, very individual resentment of each particular citizen in Russia. Whether we're talking about old-timers or we're talking about parts of the population which are used to living in a socialist society. What is important to understand, though, is that Zhirinovsky has been voted into the State Duma or the Russian Parliament, not just by those people who hated, and I'm using strong word hated because it was hated, who hated Yeltsin's reforms or his managing of the economy or his advisors. Zhirinovsky's success could be also explained because some of the intellectuals or some of the people of the very liberal mindset were voting for Zhirinovsky as well. Because in October and November of 1993, a lot of people were extremely upset about Yeltsin attacking militarily at the White House, and in their view, breaking the basic law of the country, the constitution. And also brutally punishing all the opponents after the attack, introducing censorship system in the media again, even though it was for a week. I believe that those particular moves on the Yeltsin's part were clearly a mistake, and also showed the nation that it doesn't have the leader it had before, not the leader of August 1991. I also believe that those liberally minded people understood that if they're not going to vote for some kind of alternative, they will be voting for their for Yeltsin, the right winger. And they decided, why not Zhirinovsky, although they knew, or and they proven to be wrong, they knew that he's going to fail, because they thought Zhirinovsky is not going to make it, because they believe that if they will not vote for somebody like Zhirinovsky or somebody else, the so-called Democrats of 1981 or Yeltsin's people will come to power again. And they wanted to see the alternative. Well, now what kind of alternative they got? They were scared to death to see that their votes were cast for the people, for the person who actually is much more dangerous than Yeltsin is. Now, one should take into account that Zhirinovsky poured out as much as $1 million U.S. dollars into his election campaign, which was never made for neither Yeltsin nor by his opponents. He was the first one who employed Western Public Relations Agency to help him out during the campaign. And the people who voted for him, whether they were liberals or conservatives, were very much surprised to see the outcome. If you look at Zhirinovsky before and after the election, he was not that aggressive before. He had ambitious plans of territory eating, whether it's Russia or Eastern Bloc or somewhere else, before the elections, but he never made them openly public, and they became public only after the elections themselves.